You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Okay, it's Joan Rivers. I'm here talking instead of poor Leonard Lopate, who's probably going to ruin my show. But I've got a wonderful book to talk to you about next. Pick up the newspaper today, and the Middle East is in total turmoil. Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, the turbulence absolutely defies belief. And 5 years earlier, if you remember, on November 26, 2008, a mere 10 gunmen traveled by boat from Pakistan to Mumbai, India's financial capital and the fourth most populated city in the world. And upon arrival, they launched 12 highly coordinated shootings and bombing attacks all across the city. It took a paralyzed India 3 long days to put an end to it, and by then 166 people had been killed, many other wounded. We all had our eyes, we were watching the whole thing on television, if you remember. And one of the things we saw over and over and over again, the Taj Mahal Palace Hotel, which is a 5-star hotel, one of the world's great hotels, was a prime target. And it was leaving their guests no chance to get out. If you got out, you were going to get shot, or you could lock yourself in your room, or you were going to get burned. The hotel went up in flames. It was a mess and a horror. British journalists Kathy Scott Clark and Adrian Levy have meticulously recreated what exactly went inside in that hotel, scene by scene, hour by hour. It's terrifying. It's riveting. It's beyond disturbing. The book is called The Siege, 68 Hours Inside the Taj Hotel. And we're lucky enough to have with me today Adrian Levy, who is one of the writers. And I'm trying to find, are you there?
I'm here. How are you? Nice to be with you.
Wonderful to talk with you. And your exact credits, I'm trying to find them, but I'm sitting here filled with different papers. So tell me exactly. Here we go.
Oh, well,
you're an award-winning, I wanted to make sure, I was very impressed when I read that. You're an award-winning journalist, you're a filmmaker, and you write for The Guardian, and the book is extraordinary.
Well, that's really kind of you. I mean, I've had a kind of on-off love affair with India, and Kathy, my wife, too, for half my life, more than 20 years, and it's a compelling, frustrating, intoxicating subcontinent, and once you start working there, it's really hard to stop. And that was one of the reasons we wanted to come to this extraordinary event in 2008. I mean, we have so many friends in Mumbai. We were passing through with our young children and missed it by 2 days.
Why would they? I understand why they picked Mumbai, but why a hotel? Why kill people that had nothing to do with anything? Totally non-political people. I mean, it's just terrifying.
Well, I mean, one of the most extraordinary things is that the group that was behind this this attack, Lashkar-e-Toiba, which means Army of the Pure, Pakistan-based group that's been around since the early 1990s, that group was falling to pieces, and they were looking for a kind of band-aid, a sticking plaster, a shop window event that would bind together the organisation, get them live viewing time around the world, broadcast who they were, put together a kind of grisly advertising package. They'd been largely upstaged by Al-Qaeda and other organisations. And one faction, the younger faction, wanted to be like Al-Qaeda. The older faction wanted just to attack Kashmir, the traditional target for a group like this. And here in Mumbai, they had the opportunity to attack Jews, Christians, Westerners, Indians, all brought together in this sort of fabulous city, the fourth most populous city in the world. And that's why they chose it. It was a way of touching out, reaching out to all of their constituent parts and satisfying all of them.
And what did this do 166 deaths later? What did it do? The Taj is rebuilt. Mumbai goes on. We have to figure out over and over again what Lashkar is. What the hell did this do?
Well, this is the extraordinary thing. I mean, in one sense, it showed India to be what India really is. I mean, India was remarkably unhawkish after the attack. I mean, everyone expected there to be some kind of massive reprisal against the neighbour Pakistan, but nothing happened. Lashkar succeeded in what it wanted to do. It revived itself. It was all but defunct. It left after Mumbai being a brand once again in this bizarre and surreal world of Islamism, of jihad. And so in that sense, it did succeed. The investigations into the attack have yet really to prosecute any of the masterminds behind it. I mean, sure, one of the 10 men,
one of the 10 gunmen survived,
and he was prosecuted and he was hanged by the Indian state. But the masterminds behind the attack, they walked free, and they're still around in Pakistan. We met with several of them.
And let me ask you, so we're going to get into that, because, I mean, the whole thing is so scary. How much did the CIA know? How much did they really all know what was going on? Because you talk about this in the book.
This is one of the most extraordinary features of this attack. I mean, it was one of those slow-moving car crashes. Everyone knew about it for the 2 years it took to get this operation together. It was watched painstakingly by the CIA. American intelligence had a man inside the operation who was reporting back. And digests of what he saw and said were wrapped up and passed to the Indians. From 2006 onwards, the Indians knew that Mumbai would be targeted, that it was Lashkar who would target it, that the attack would come by sea. It would be roughly a dozen young boys, average age 21. They knew the methodology, and they knew nearly all of the targets apart from one Jewish centre. And yet, you know, nothing really was done to thwart the operation. And at the same time, American intelligence didn't reveal the nature of their source, because they were keen for that source to move ever closer towards Osama bin Laden. And prior to the raid in Abbottabad, where bin Laden was finally run to ground, this was the nearest America had got to capturing Osama. So there was an interest here in letting the operation run.
I'm talking with Adrian Levy, and the book is called The Siege, 68 Hours Inside the Taj Hotel. Gripping. The way you do the book is you go back and forth. Talk a little, if you could, about I was fascinated by how they found the terrorists, how they trained the terrorists, how naive these boys were, how they were like children. They had never seen a big city before. And also their fundamentalist faith that they can slit a man's throat and they get down and pray to Allah, to Muhammad, I guess, for good luck. I mean, the whole thing is insane. Talk about how they trained them and how they found them, if you would.
Yeah, this was another extraordinary thing. I mean, they went through a rigorous recruiting process, but they reached into, as of course all of us know, into the poorest, most dysfunctional areas, communities where there is nothing, where the government does not operate. There are no employment prospects and no schools. And they found young, semi-illiterate candidates, if you like, and then put them through a process of making them childlike. The whole regime was designed to get them to relinquish their will and to become children in the care of the jihad organization. And the people they chose were not religious. They were not especially political. They had no experience outside the farming belts in which they lived. And into these blank canvases, they stuffed extreme ideas and created puppets for them to manipulate. And then eventually, when they were ready, they took them down to the coast and got them ready to launch them in ships in a boat that would head from Pakistan to India. And that was the first time that any of these guys had even seen the sea. I mean, we're talking about very simple country boys who are being manipulated. And there's one other key thing here, which shows you the cruelty of what happened. Oh. A control room was set up in Pakistan. And in that control room, they had phones with a Skype-like system that linked through to the boys who were in Mumbai. And at every stage, whenever the boys resisted, got scared, hungry, cold, they'd be bullied over the phone and G'd up and told to go ahead. And when you listen to those conversations, because they were all intercepted by the CIA and by Indian intelligence, it's like a father talking to an angry child. It's the same way when I get frustrated with my son and I'm trying to G him up to do his music practice. I mean, it's that tone, you know, persuading them to kill with more gusto, persuading them to set more fires, persuading them to kill more passengers in the train station. And that really is something horrifying,
horrifying.
That ventriloquism.
And at the same, they taught them how to torture, but they also taught them technology. I mean, I found that fascinating.
Yeah.
They absolutely taught them how to be robotic terrorists. Who paid
for this?
Yeah,
I mean, Incredible. Well, you know, this is the remarkable thing about the age we live in now. This operation cost only $40,000 to run. You could hold the world's fourth largest city hostage for $40,000. And it shows you that it really the technologies are there. It's using essentially a couple of TV screens, broadband, Google Earth. And they trained using Google Earth because they couldn't afford for these peasants to sort of set off to Mumbai and have recce. So instead they put them in a room and had them zooming around the city using mapping programs. But the operation was, you know, relatively cheap to run and paid for using funds gathered all over the country and from the Gulf states from the sponsors of the Army of the Pure.
Yeah. Could this happen here? Could somebody come in to New York Harbor and take over? I was shocked how few the security people, totally unprepared. They couldn't get anybody to come into the hotels. Nobody was able to communicate with anybody else. The security guards didn't have guns. I mean, it's astonishing.
It is astonishing. I think the lack of preparedness was then compounded by the lack of ability to deal with the crisis when it happened. And it was left to the people of Mumbai and the guests of the city to defend themselves. And the city did save itself remarkably. I mean, ordinary people did extraordinary things. And, you know, there were upwards of 2,000 people with staff and guests in the Taj Hotel. And nearly all of those were rescued by themselves. You know, they were rescued by the very lowly paid, wonderful, loyal staff, or they were rescued by each other. You know, soon afterwards, when the smoke cleared, I mean, police chiefs from all over the world and intelligence chiefs converged on Mumbai to have a look and see, you know, could this happen in London? Could it happen in New York or Washington or any other great American city? And of course it could do. I mean, the methodology may be slightly different, but it could happen. And we're all open to these kind of attacks. Broadly, you know, we live in an open society and our cities are now targets. And this is a great worry. And, you know, you should have seen the look on the police chiefs' faces around the world at this conference in Mumbai. Everyone was concerned.
I found so moving in the book the stories of the heroes, the heroism that went on, as well as, let's talk about some of the ordinary people that turned into heroes. What are one of your favorite stories?
Oh, there were so many. I mean, this is really what drew me into this book, was actually the ordinary people who were extraordinary. I mean, there's a remarkable restaurant manager, young guy called Amit Pashave, who ran the 24-hour coffee shop on the ground floor and the poolside bar. And he was stressing out because he had too many responsibilities, and it was the busiest day of the year, and there were weddings in the hotel, and it was running at maximum capacity. And yet, he had the opportunity to run as soon as the gunman arrived. And instead, he turned himself around, went back into the firing line, and got virtually everybody in the coffee shop out through an emergency exit and then hiding inside the shrubbery while the gunman walked past, executing people in front of them, keeping everyone quiet, and then left his hiding place to try and rescue the young son of one of the guests who was locked inside a toilet, and on the way had a grenade thrown at him that miraculously didn't explode, had a gun levelled at his head and discharged, and he tripped over backwards and the bullet missed his temple. And yet he still, despite these near-death experiences, went on to evacuate everyone in his charge. And if I may, there's one other example at the other end of an American. A very mild-mannered guy called Ravi Dhanadarkar, who was a captain in the US Marines, a pilot. And he was up on the 20th floor in a restaurant. And along with a couple of other people, he managed to evacuate 200-300 people down 20 floors in the way of snipers, get them out into the dark, having created a barricade initially, and then vanished into the night without telling anybody who he was, having destroyed all his own ID to protect himself and protect others around him. And that was the kind of night it was. People did not do this for fame or attention. They did what they had to do to survive.
Oh, much more than what they had to do. I mean,
yeah, much more.
Things come out of people that you don't expect. We'll be Right back in a second. I'm speaking with the journalist Adrian Levy about the book, The Siege, 68 Hours Inside the Taj Hotel, which he's co-written with his wife, Kathy Scott Clark. It's published by Penguin Books. Oh, they're my publishers, too. That should get me some points. And we'll have more right after this break. We are definitely back. It's Joan Rivers. I am talking with Adrian Levy. And the book is called The Siege, 68 Hours Inside the Taj Hotel, which he wrote with his wife. How do you write with your wife? Who says that's stupid?
It's
garbage.
It's taken a long time.
Yeah. How do you do the research? Do you do it together? Do you both go off and do it? You went into very difficult, which you're going to get to, and very unsafe areas to do your research. And you just said you have a son. Did the two of you go in and do it?
Yeah, no, we don't. It's a revolving door, and we, one of us works, and then the other one will do a trip, and then we pass the children over in between hands, and we've both got different things that we're looking for, and different ways of working with people, and we split everything up at the beginning, and then cut it in half, and then when we're writing, we kind of don't talk to each other for about 6 months, except by email. And we kind of just send each other these email updates on what we're thinking and where we're going. And then at the end of the day, when the children come home, then the family life takes over, and we try and puts the back of our minds what we've been doing in the day. But towards the end of a book like this, you get stuck. And I was just stuck in November 2008, and the children would come back from school, and it was impossible to get my head out of the Taj Hotel and Mumbai, and there's a terribly difficult transition as you drag yourself back into the world of
reality,
of reality, and young kids, and making tea, and getting things going for the day.
Especially when you went in, talk about you mentioned it a little bit when we first started speaking, that you went and interviewed some of the terrorists. I mean, and you went into places where you had to go so gingerly that right before you they had found some people they didn't like, and they had literally executed them. I mean, you went to the training camp.
Yeah, I mean, we've spent ages.
How did you get in there? Why did they let you in when they had to know you weren't going to write a book going, these guys are terrific?
Been doing it for quite a long time. And,
Who brought you in?
20 years backwards and forwards, making friends. Never tell a lie. Always and straight with people. Always show them what I'm doing and how I'm doing it. Build friendships. Stick with those friends. Never burn them. And it has taken a long time to get accepted in any way. And those relationships have led to bizarre doors opening. I mean, you can tell from my name that I'm from a Jewish background, and so that conversation is always amongst the first when I sit down in some of these rooms. Can I explain what my views might be on, and there'll be all sorts of goading that takes place, which you have to be very careful in the way that you manage. And in my mind is always, cautionary tales like Daniel Pearl. I'm sure it is with you and for everyone else.
It comes to mind constantly when they beheaded him on camera, if we remember.
So, I mean, it's about managing risk and doing something that you're comfortable with and, at each stage being with people that you know and trust. And we've grown up working in Pakistan and Afghanistan and India and South Asia, and it's, every time, every story, we plan it meticulously and build our relationships all over again. And there's an element of risk.
But you're dealing with very primitive, very strange people. I mean, we know they kidnap, journalists are kidnapped, journalists are this. And you really walk into territory that's very, very, very hard. Do you think it's ever going to stop? I mean, I know we're talking very stupid, broad terms. But I mean, is there a light at the end of this tunnel?
No, I don't think so at the moment. I think the problem is that there's an absence of government. And, in the absence of government, there are organizations who manipulate the poor. And that's taking place throughout large areas of Pakistan. And those groups have also been manipulated for a long time by governments who use them as their covert foreign policy. And it's impossible to see that coming to an end, And even if you met their demands, and you drove all the Jews into the sea and you gave back Israel and Kashmir was reunited, there'd be another issue that came up. And I don't think it's anything really to do with those issues at all. It's a political movement. It has its own political goals and its own politicians who are very effective communicators. and they raise a huge amount of money. And what they do at the moment is hard to beat.
Where, in general, does Pakistan really stand?
Wow. Well, I think someone once said to me, and
trust
I think this is not a
Socratic question. I don't know the answer.
I'm not sure I do, but someone once said to me, a much cleverer person than me, that Pakistan always threatens America by putting a gun against its own head and saying, you know, unless you do this, I'm going to shoot myself in the head. And I think that's the starting point. It's a nuclear armed state that's permanently on the verge of crisis. And, you know, the way in which it's been wooed by American administrations over the years has been both inconsistent and also lacking any kind of longevity in terms of the policies that, you know, it's rewarded continually with American military aid because the West needs to have an Islamic bulwark, a security client. And at the same time, it betrays its allies because, of course, it needs to advance its own foreign policy. And its foreign policy is inconsistent with ours, broadly speaking. But that's the bad news. There is some good news, which is that there's a civilian government. Let me give you some good news.
You have a very pretty cover on your book.
Cheers. That's good news. And also, look.
They rebuilt the hotel and the coffee shop's terrific. Let me hear the good news.
There's lots of good news. First of all, I want to say that, you know, out of this terrible tragedy, these, you know, remarkable stories of bravery take place. And the same thing happens in Pakistan. I mean, myself and Kathy worked for ages with the civilian authorities, with the government, with the police, once with the bomb squad. And you meet these extraordinary, clever, witty individuals, writers, broadcasters, filmmakers, and some politicians who are trying to renew their country. And they are themselves wonderfully cultured and witty. And they work incredibly hard. The bad news is that, you know, it's an uphill struggle.
Right.
And all of our lives depend on their success.
You know, we read all these books and all these spy books and we see all these Arnold Schwarzenegger movies and all this stuff. And then you read this talk about the American-born Pakistani David Headley.
I mean, yeah, extraordinary.
Extraordinary story. Who was he, a double agent? Was he a triple agent? I mean, bad boy.
What does that mean even?
Yeah, I mean, explain this to me.
He's remarkable. I mean, this guy is a chameleon. His mother was Cyril Headley, a philanthropist from Maryland, whose family had funded the research of Albert Einstein. And she fell in love in the late 1950s with one of Pakistan's most formidable and lyrical broadcasters. And so this marriage, unusual marriage, got together, and the product of the marriage was David Headley, half Pakistani, half American. And he spent his youth in Pakistan, and then he came back and lived with his mother in his teens in the Upper West Side, eventually in the Upper West Side of New York, where he opened a video store. And so he was someone who was comfortable in both worlds. And at an early age, he realised that he could manipulate both worlds and use them to his advantage. And you ask, you know, was he a single agent, a double agent, a triple agent? I think the story with David Headley is that he only ever pleased himself. He only ever served himself. He became a drug dealer. And when he was a drug dealer, he betrayed everybody, constantly betrayed his best friend, going behind his back, using his military credentials in Pakistan to deal drugs. He betrayed the drug syndicate to do a deal with the DEA. He then betrayed DEA to do deals with Islamists. And then when the war on terror began, after the embassies were blown up, the US embassies were blown up in Africa, he did deals with the American intelligence community, betraying everyone else in order to get himself out of a hotspot.
Also, they thought that he would get them
Osama. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he was, if you imagine, I mean, he was a tantalising proposition. An American who could look like a Pakistani, who could speak like a Pakistani, who had dual nationalities, and who could move freely in the world of Islamists at a time when no other American could. So, I mean, he was a tantalising proposition. And he betrayed everyone continually, only ever servicing himself. And, you know, in a sense, he's done that now. He came up with the idea of the Mumbai attacks. He penetrated the organization that would then take on the attacks. He fed information back to American intelligence while still working for that organization, betrayed that organization, that also believed that he was probably a traitor halfway through their planning, and began to distance itself from him. And even now he's done a deal, you know. I mean, he was eventually caught by British intelligence in 2009, 2010. And he then did a deal with the authorities in America, and received a short custodial sentence for the crimes that he committed, a relatively short sentence, no death sentence certainly, and no doubt will be deal making for the rest of his life.
Couldn't exist in fiction. Somebody like
it just couldn't, absolutely yeah. couldn't. I was trying to think who would play him in the movie. It's such an extraordinary role.
That's Meryl Streep. She can do anything.
I think you're right.
Talk more, if you would, about the tragedies. Who was it that was in the? His daughter called him on the cell phone, and because the cell phone rang, they found him.
Oh, I mean, the stories that break your heart.
Yes, I mean, things that you go, oh. The book is the book again is The Siege by the 68 hours inside the Taj Mahal Hotel, and it's just one story after the next. But tell that one, which really knocked me out.
Yeah, me too.
And then The British Lovers, which also killed me. Yeah, Will incredible. Pike and Kelly.
Yeah, I'll give you two sort of thumbnail sketches. I mean, the first one, there was a girl who'd just begun working. Her dad, his whole life spent working in the Taj as the head of the wait team, working in the Sea Lounge, this wonderful first floor cafe overlooking the gateway to India. And he'd got his daughter a job working in the computer room, always wanted her to work in the hotel. The siege happens. He's left his shift to leave the hotel and realises his daughter is hiding inside the hotel. And so he goes against the current of everyone fleeing and breaks back into the hotel to try and rescue his daughter. Can't get to her, tries again, doesn't heed anyone's advice. Eventually makes it into the kitchens and decides to hide inside a meat safe, a cool room with two other employees. And his daughter, meanwhile, is stranded in a room, hiding underneath a desk with a chair pulled in front of her. And the terrorists are creeping in and out of that room, looking for people to shoot and take hostage. And she can see boots passing by the chair, and she can barely breathe. And eventually, when the room becomes clear of terrorists but begins to fill with smoke, in complete horror, she reaches for a phone and she dials a number, punches a number into the mobile. And it's her father's mobile. His mobile rings one floor below in the meat safe, and the ringing is heard by the terrorists who shoot him through the window of the door. A heartbreaking story.
Heartbreaking.
And she wouldn't find out for days. She herself was marooned inside the hotel for another 2 days before people could find her and coax her out of her hiding place.
Now, to end this on a slightly happier note, let me ask you, at the end of all this, did the Taj get all its stars back?
Yeah, it's still a great, great, great,
it's
great place to be. The
hotel.
Food is wonderful. The same staff, nearly all, apart from, of course, the tragedy.
How
they're still
sad.
Working there.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book. I thank you so much. What are you working on next? Because now I want to get the next book. This book is so good.
We're working on a story based with Americans and Pakistanis, yet again a similar theme. We're just doing the deal now, so it's an absolute top secret, and I'm not allowed to tell you, but it's going to be announced next week. So
okay,
I'm
can I just
forward to that.
Tell you and your wife one thing? Please be careful.
We will do, yeah, of course. Thank you so much for having us on.
A pleasure. Thank you so much again, Adrian Levy. The book, The Siege, 68 Hours Inside the Taj Mahal. This is Joan Rivers. And as I said, I've been speaking with Adrian Levy. The book is published by Penguin Books. Thank you for joining us. Up next, we're going to end on a slightly happier up note with the comedians. We're going to talk about comedy and comedians. We're going to have Dean Cole and Billy Eichner and Rez Farrakhan. And we're going to talk about what it is to be a comedian in this society when terrorists can take over a city, et cetera, et cetera. And later on today's Science Friday, you're going to find out why this frigid cold snap can actually have a silver lining, because it might kill off bugs that are eating away at forests and my legs. Coming up at 2 on 93.9 FNWNYC. I'm Joan Rivers in today for Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC and WNYC.org. Thank you.